Welcome to Follow the Sounds This Week in Music History. Each week we scour the internet looking for interesting facts for your enjoyment. I am your host, Brian Kroc, and along with me for this ride is, of course, Jacob Crum, who is currently sick.
Yeah, I'm going to make it.
He'll be fine.
I'm going to make it.
And along with me, of course, is Greg Harvey.
I'm back in action.
Back in action. And joining us for the night is Bree Park.
Hello.
So, Bree, it's been a while.
It has.
It's good to have you back.
Thank you. I'm glad to be back.
So, we offered a standing invite anytime you ever wanted to show up, so I'm glad. And we didn't find out that you were showing up until, like, the last minute anyway, so we're cool. Mm-hmm. Everything is perfectly fine, and
surprise,
I'm enjoying
it's
it. So.
That's exactly how we like to operate around here.
Yes. So, obviously, we have a great week of music history to get through. We're going for May 15th through May 19th, and I think we got some very interesting facts this particular week. But starting it off, May 15th, 1948, born on this day, the great Brian Eno.
Ooh.
So, of course, Brian Eno, very well known for, you know, the synthesizers and, like, beyond just the music that he created an entire method of creating music. And that's just impressive in and of itself. So there you go. Brian Eno just doing good work.
Can I just say that when I think of Brian Eno, I think of him in the early 70s as being like a more British Ziggy Stardust.
I could see that.
You know, just like like kimonos and raven feathers. And
that was pretty standard in the 70s, though.
Yeah. Yeah. That's pretty true. And then moving on, let's go to 1975. Anybody? Anybody? 1975. Very interesting thing happened at this particular time. I'm going to take this one, Jake, because I know this one. So Fleetwood Mac plays their very first show with Stevie Nicks and Lindsey Buckingham. Now, as some of the people who have listened to the show before, thank you all 10 of you, my wife is like a huge Lindsey Buckingham and Fleetwood Mac fan. So I've heard this story 1,000 times about how Lindsey and Stevie ended up joining Fleetwood Mac. And what it was is that they had just lost like their previous lead singer and guitar player. And Mick Fleetwood was looking for another guitar player to sort of fill in that slot. And he went to the recording studio where Lindsey and Stevie had recorded their first album, Buckingham Nicks. Mm-hmm. And if you've never heard Buckingham Nicks, you are missing out. It is a fantastic album. And some of the songs on there actually do appear on the first Fleetwood Mac album with them. And so the guy played him a clip of Lindsey playing guitar. And he's like, that's awesome. It's like, I want this guy. This dude is like fantastic. Lindsey then shows up and is like, I won't do it unless Stevie's with me. And he's like, okay, fine, whatever, duo, let's do it. So they bring them on. Everybody merges together, form Fleetwood Mac, becomes super huge and famous after the release of Rumors. Boom.
I love Fleetwood Mac.
They are good, and they are good in concert.
I would love to see them in concert.
I saw them in concert at the O2 in London.
Wow, how was that?
Fan-frickin-tastic.
Was it one of your top 10 concerts of all time?
Oh, man. Honestly, yeah, just because of the location itself. So, wife and I took a boat up the Thames on a whim, actually. We had just gotten done touring the Tower of London, took a boat up the Thames, and because it drops you right off at the O2. We walk up there, and we're like, hey, are there any tickets available? And they're like, yeah, sure. So we bought tickets. We go in there, and it's like, boom, Fleetwood Mac. In London, playing to a sold-out show, basically.
Wow. And you just walk up like, hey.
That's what I was thinking.
Want to go see Fleetwood Mac? Okay.
How readily available those tickets were.
I know. I
mean, yeah, it wasn't too expensive either. So.
Tickets. You want tickets, sir. How about you?
The best part, though, from that was we were sitting there, and there were a couple of, like, you know, maybe 20-something sitting in front of us. It's like, which one I wouldn't expect at a Fleetwood Mac concert. I've seen them. I mean, mind you, I saw Fleetwood Mac in St. Louis, front row, dead center. I'm talking, I was less than 10 feet from Lindsey, less than 10 feet from Stevie, and like it was a perfect sort of wall of sound that I really enjoyed.
You could really feel the sweat.
So, but these kids in front of us, like, you know, we started talking. They heard that we were, you know, they heard our accent. They knew we were American. They start talking to us about where we're from and everything. We go, oh, we're from St. Louis. And they're like, oh, St. Louis, blah, blah, blah. And they start asking questions like, you know, how like this was before the Rams left. And so they're like, how are the Rams and blah, blah, blah. And we're just like, really? It's like you actually know about like our sports teams. And they're like, well, yeah. Because Kroenke owned the Rams, or still owns the Rams, and he also owns Manchester United, I think. Oh, I don't remember. Wow. One of those clubs over there, but he owns that one too. So that's how they actually knew about all that stuff. It's just really weird.
Huh.
So there you go. That's my Fleetwood Mac at the O2 concert story.
Cool.
Good stuff.
Yeah.
We then had to try and get home, and it took us like an hour and a half using buses. We took the N19 to Sudbury. And I know that because that line was repeated like 50 times on our way home. You're on the N19 to Sudbury.
Bing!
All right, moving on up to 1982. Here you go, Jake.
Mm-hmm.
This is the one for you.
I know it is.
Paul McCartney and Stevie Wonder start a 7-week run at number one on the U.S. singles charts with Ebony and Ivory. Live together in perfect harmony.
I'm really
honestly
glad you did that.
I've never cared for the melody of that song. I think it does everything it can to dumb down Stevie's voice so that Paul could keep up with him, and I hate the song for it.
It was later named as the 10th worst song of all time by Blender Magazine in 2007. And in 2007, it was named the worst duet in history by the BBC.
Aww.
I think people would just have expected a lot more from the combination of Paul McCartney and Stevie Wonder. And then it came out and it was like, ew.
That is true. It's supposed that would be like the super group being put together and then putting out the B-side or something, you know?
Absolutely. Which is great because that song was actually the ending song to my first radio program. Because I did it with my good friend Arlington Lane, who is black, and so he was Ebony, I was Ivory. So there you go. That's how it played out. Let's see. In 1997, Oasis became one of the first artists to attempt to exert censorship over the internet. The group was working with Sony to put an end to unofficial websites carrying lyrics, sound files, and photographs of the band.
Oh, how the times have changed.
Yeah, now that stuff is like, you want people making that stuff. That's a sign of how famous you've become.
Yeah, it's like when you just Google the song name and you just see all the results from all the different websites being like, do you want the lyrics? Do you want to see the video? Do you want to read the Wikipedia? Like, it's just everywhere.
So it's just funny in 1997 because, you know, it's like a bunch of like Angel Fire sites like
I was
that are just
say, yeah.
thrown together. Which is also then funny, and I'm totally going to throw it back to the Fleetwood Mac thing. So my wife actually ran the website for Lindsey Buckingham, like the official website for Lindsey Buckingham. She did that by starting a fan site and then convincing his management to let her sort of set up an official site. And then she managed all of that and actually got some really cool content. So
wow.
When I was 13, I had an NSYNC fan page on GeoCities. Lots of sound clips and photos.
So my wife did something similar, except she did it a couple years later. And then, of course, like actually
significantly better.
Got a real deal like from them. And it then allowed her to basically tour around and see Lindsey Buckingham everywhere because she got free tickets whenever she wanted. So
I need to get with your wife and learn how to hustle.
So
she's got it.
Well,
she's got it
yeah,
down.
That's one of the reasons why I married her. So, because I certainly don't have that hustle. So I borrow hers.
Aw.
All right. Let's all see. Right. Here you go, Jake.
Yes. 2001. Weezer releases Weezer again.
The Green Album.
Yeah. For the second time.
We had this discussion last week.
Yes, we did.
Because you didn't know why they have like multiple self-titled albums.
No, I still don't. Is it apathy?
Just the colors,
it can't be lack of imagination.
The colors, Jake. The colors!
Then hide it better. And then, like, 3 years now, everyone will be like, oh, man, all their albums are colors.
It's pretty obvious.
Eventually, they'll make a rainbow.
I don't know.
It's just the four band members in front of a different color every time.
Yes, yeah, I get that. Like, what's so hard about putting a name? Any name, Grubbs.
So are you telling...
What do you expect from an album called Grubs?
Like, okay, album titles now have expectations attached to any of them?
Yes.
Yes?
No.
Yes.
See, here,
I like
here's
it.
Kind of, here, here's the way that I yes. kind of thought of it mm-hmm. later on. Mm-hmm. All right. Is that, you know, Weezer, the Blue Album, was the initial start of Rivers Cuomo. It was him sort of doing some autobiographical stuff, right? And then he released Pinkerton, you know, of which was sort of in a different direction. Then they released the Green Album. And I think the Green Album is sort of like that next step of Rivers Cuomo's life and sort of it being another like representation. So if you think of like Weezer as an album name, it's sort of synonymous with Rivers Cuomo's life.
It's an ever evolving
Which is
spectrum.
A better title. River Cuomo's Life is a better title. Volume 3. That's a better title.
See, I think it's lazy though that Adele just names hers numbers and it's whatever age she is when she records them.
Yeah. No, that's less lazy than the same name with the different colored background.
I like it.
So what happens? What happens when you have the pink and the mauve album?
What about Led Zeppelin?
What about them?
1, 2, 3, 4. Yeah. Like really? Like people just name them names.
Yeah, but they, numbers like, make sense.
It's at least like, they're in order.
And now we've declared
it's not
a thumb
the
war.
Blue Album something different, and then the,
and I told you this last week too. Really... What about the Beatles' White Album?
Why do they?
What about it?
Just saying, it's like what?
It's a color. Are you mad?
They should have come up with a better name.
Well, they didn't come up with any name.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So there you go.
Oh, right. I guess I see your point.
So they're
now.
Posers then. They're off the hardworking backs of the Beatles.
They're making the fans name the albums for them.
Is the Earth flat?
All the
Jacob?
Fans are doing terrible. are doing a terrible job at it.
Everybody knows that Antarctica is a 100-foot wall of ice that surrounds the flat disk of the Earth. All right. I am kidding. If anybody's actually listening to this, I am not a flat earther. I'm sorry. So I just know all of their arguments.
Let's get into some ridiculous that's at least entertaining.
Mm-hmm.
In 2002, the Wu-Tang Clan name generator goes live, and the world was never the same.
That is true.
Yes. Donald Glover's... artist name, Childish Gambino, came directly from the Wu-Tang Clan generator. Mm-hmm. You can go and type his name into it right now, and it comes up like that every time.
Hmm. Wow.
I love that about him, that he used his Wu-Tang Clan name generator as his, like, actual...
I don't think I remember what name I got.
I don't remember.
Oh, either. I can tell you.
I used the name generator.
Because I put him in.
Oh, did you do all of us?
I did.
Oh, this is going to be good.
Oh, you've got...
Okay.
Jake comes prepared. Good Lord.
Of course I did.
All right, go for it.
All right, so we got our captain over here, who I like to call Zexy Prophet.
Zexy Prophet.
Mm-hmm.
That's
brilliant. I love it.
Yes, and sitting to his right, our co-host, the Mad Commander, Mr. Harvey.
Sweet.
And, of course, he brought with him who? The intellectual Killer Bree.
Oh.
And we're going to round this out with Erratic Lover. Crumb.
Erratic.
Yeah, that's
Erratic Lover.
Hyphen Radic.
Awesome.
Lover.
Erratic Lover.
The Mad Commander.
It's funny. I'm going to bring this up again, though. I actually used a name generator to get the name of my first radio program, which was The Radio Takeover. So there you go.
Oh.
Mine was called The Morning Brew because I would drink a beer during the show.
As one does in the morning.
It was college radio.
Of course it was. As one does in the morning.
I had the house party with Harv.
That's cute.
The door's open. Come on in.
Wow.
House party with Harv.
That's great. Moving on up to 2003, a sad day in music history. Country singer June Carter Cash, the second wife of Johnny Cash, died in Nashville, Tennessee, of complications following a heart valve replacement surgery. She was 73 years old. She was, of course, a member of the Carter family, had some massive hits with Johnny Cash, and won some Grammy Awards for the songs like Jackson and Ring of Fire and If I Were a Carpenter. Sad day.
I like Jackson.
June Carter Cash.
Oh, I like the Cash family.
June was a funny lady. She was really funny, actually. If you go back and you listen to any of the stuff that that the Carpenters did, especially like all the Grand Ole Opry stuff,
mm-hmm.
she is brilliant. She is very, very fast, like in coming up with stuff. So smart, smart girl.
I worked with a guy on a job site that would make me sing Jackson every day because he would laugh his ass off when I got to the line "Hotter than a pepper sprout."
Hotter than a pepper sprout.
I don't know why, but that's.
I used to work at a bar that was made of two emptied grain silos, and it was called the Corn Crib with K's. Hmm. And I'd host karaoke there every Friday, and it never failed. Somebody would be like, "I need a girl to sing Jackson with me. You got to do it because you're hosting, right?" Oh, okay.
That was a pretty good impersonation there. I totally bought that.
That was every patron at the Corn Crib.
Every patron.
Anytime you need somebody to sing a Jim Carter.
Anytime though,
just,
I see.
Throw me at it. I'll fill in for you.
Anytime where I see names though that are like they swap out like C's with K's, it automatically makes me think of the Klan, just because that's what they did for like their secret language. They replaced things with K's.
It was a small town country redneck bar.
That's quite. That's possible then.
It's their version of Pig Latin is. White.
Everybody knows Sunday nights we got them special meetings mm-hmm. for a certain secret society.
Jeez.
Dollar drafts on Sunday.
Well, luckily for a band in Russia, the death of June Carter overshadowed their tragedy because also on that day in 2003, the manager of Tattoo was arrested for disturbing the peace at the Red Square in Moscow.
How did he disturb the peace?
Okay, you remember the video where they kiss and like everybody was like, "Oh!"
All the things she said.
They weren't even real lesbians. So,
yeah, Tattoo was like the fake lesbians.
Right. Well, they were going to shoot a new video, so he had gotten like put out posters to inviting young ladies to come down and kiss each other, pair up and kiss a random person for this new video. And in the middle of filming it, they came and arrested him.
I just felt the most fiery rage in my gut when you said that. Please, a bunch of young girls come and kiss for my video that I'm making with two Russians that I'm making pretend to be lesbians.
Look, I'm not the sleazebag that came up with the idea. All right?
I wasn't mad at you.
Yeah. I realize that.
It's palpably
falling off of you and rolling towards me and out the door.
Young ladies, come to square, kiss each other. I will film.
But just remember when they did the MTV Music Awards and the whole point of their performance at the VMAs was, I know you guys think this is risque, but we're rebellious and we're girls and we're gonna kiss anyway. But it was just like everybody in the LGBTQ community was just like, but they ain't gay, so.
And that was before they even had those letters.
Mm-hmm. Just walk around.
2003, maybe.
Hmm. And maybe it was just
I don't know.
LGB at that point. Lesbian, gay, bisexual.
I don't even think bisexuals were at the point where there was recognition at that early in the. We were still being yelled at for not choosing a side.
All right, Jake, so, let's continue on to May 16th.
All right. Going back a little bit here for this one. 1767.
That's old.
Yes.
Not the farthest back date that we've had, very far back.
But at the Covent Garden Theater in London. Gentleman walked out on the stage and announced that Miss Brickler will be singing accompanied by Mr. Dibdin on a new instrument called pianoforte. It was the first time that a piano was played in public.
Wow. In stereo.
It was an opera. and I'm so bad at Italian, I didn't bother to write the name of it down.
Oh, you should have. I could have gotten it for you.
Yeah, well, you know.
I can surprisingly read Italian.
Yeah,
I just have no idea what I'm saying.
Much better than I do. I can't fart my way through
it. It's weird. It's one of those things like I can see it and I know just phonetically how it's supposed to be pronounced. And so I can read it pretty well. Like not obviously not like an Italian, but I can fake it pretty well. Yeah. So I just have no idea what I'm saying.
So like Brian could be like on an Italian soap opera as long as he just reads the script, but he has no idea what his lines are.
I'm pretty good at mimicry. So yeah, I could pull that off or be like on a South Korean soap opera. I could probably pull that off.
Mm-hmm. All the Italians in
if
my
Conan
family
O'Brien could do it, I could.
Huh? It's all the Italians in my family. We just flail our arms.
Oh, yeah. Just gestures.
The only other thing I can say is that at this time, the black and the white keys were still inverted, like a harpsichord.
Yes.
Oh, wow.
Where the sharps are white and the you know. Hmm. And at this point, I don't think the piano was 72 keys yet. So I think it was at least an octave, maybe an octave and a half lower. It didn't have the higher end.
Hmm.
Interesting.
That is rather interesting. I would like to look up more information on that.
So there you go.
Thank you. Speaking of the LGBTQIA plus whatever, born on this day in 1919, Liberace.
Wow. Oh, shit.
Liberace.
There you go. I love watching like old video interviews of Liberace because people are always asking him questions and stuff, like asking him about, you know, when he's going to get married or like one of these types of things. And he's just like, oh, when I find the right woman. It's like, no.
Right.
No, Liberace. That's not going to happen.
I like to watch the old TV shows and look out at the crowd. Because, like, the median age and gender of the crowd is, like, a 62-year-old woman.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, maybe that's just who can go to, in the 50s, who could be bothered to go to, like, Merv Griffin, you know, at, like, 2 o'clock in the afternoon.
Fair. Yeah.
So that's probably every audience, but I don't know.
It's kind of funny, because I can't think of who it was that just came out that we've all known has been gay for a long time. Oh, Barry Manilow.
Oh, yeah.
He came out, and we were all just like, and? And it was like that with Liberace.
It's like, I'm sorry, like, but if you write a song called, you know, Lola, it's like, Lola, she was a showgirl. It's like, if you write that song, you're obviously gay. I'm sorry, but that's a dead giveaway.
I just kind of felt bad for Liberace because they were all trying to like
songs that make the whole world sing.
Poke him like, you're going to get a lady, Liberace? And all the whole time we've all been like, Manilow, you didn't have to tell us you were gay.
Yeah, I mean, honestly, he could have not done that at all. He's like, and it wouldn't affect his career. It's like, mm-hmm. It's not like coming out like all of a sudden made him more popular or anything.
No,
it's like, or less popular. It's like,
well, it could have been something just along the lines trying to stay relevant.
Maybe 20 years ago, it might have actually done something.
Well, but you know, there's no news.
But he's always been popular with gay people anyway, so it's not like it's that big of a deal.
I think if anything, it was just kind of a, you know, just so you know, you're. Intuition is accurate, you know, and just more of a let me publicly come out. It's probably just a thing for him personally to have publicly come out. And I kind of feel bad that, you know, Liberace just kind of got poked all the time and didn't get to live his fabulous life other than through his dress.
I, you know, honestly, though, I think that kind of good-natured ribbing was... I think he was treated better than his compatriots.
I would agree with that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like, that's probably, in the 60s, that's probably the best you could ask for was for Merv Griffin. Just go, hey, look, everybody, here's the piano player guy. I don't know.
Yeah.
Here he is.
I mean, it's not like when Elton John came out, because everybody kind of knew that, like, from very early on that he swung both ways, so.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, he's also talked about the women that he's loved in his life. So I mean, it's definitely not just gay. He's goes the bisexual route. I don't know why I had to say that, but
just for clarification,
we have our own road.
Moving on.
Ah, here we go. 1946, another birth. This one in Winborn Mister, Dorset, England. Robert Fripp from King Crimson.
Mm.
And blank stares coming.
That sounded like such.
Well, no, I mean, I know King Crimson, but it was just such a long buildup, and I was like, wait, I was still trying to process the city name, and then of course you just kept going. So
yeah, I want to try that one more time. Wimborne Minster.
Wimborne Minster. Is it one word?
You know that. You know they don't.
Word? No.
You know they don't pronounce it like that.
Right,
it's probably
right.
Like Wimminster.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's
right.
Like,
right.
Oh, we skipped like six letters.
It's called Mister.
But I don't care. I'm going to phonetically say that. I'm going to use every letter. Damn it, because it's English.
Like Leicester City. It's like it's Leicester. Like actually, is how it's spelled.
Don't they have a name of a city that's something like 56 characters long?
Yeah.
That's Welsh.
That's Welsh. But of course, the problem is that we here in St. Louis have all of these French names that we don't pronounce in French ways. So, I mean,
I don't know if you want to start me on that.
I still
do French like you do Italian. Like, I can read it, but when I speak it, my accent's just like, I'm not French, clearly. So, but I can read it very thoroughly. So I'm like, oh, chuteau. turn down Chuto. And everybody stares at me like,
it's Chowdo.
It's Chowdo. Yeah.
I worked as a temp at a U.S.-Canadian relations conference.
Ooh.
And it was hilarious to watch these French Canadians try and anticipate how I would screw up the words. Right? So, like, all these streets, like, Chowdo was Chato. Like, a who? Anyway, every conversation turned into like 7 minutes.
DeBoliver is one of my favorites.
So they were trying to relate.
Well, at least that's close.
Yeah, they were trying to anticipate how an American would screw up a French word,
oh.
And it wasn't anywhere near what is colloquially acceptable.
That's great too.
Even the name of our city though is still like St. Louis.
Right.
It's like he wasn't called St. Louis.
Bell Fountain, get out of here.
But then again, I also slam people in Louisville for pronouncing it Louisville. So
right,
yeah.
But here's something that can't be mispronounced.
Or what about Nolens?
In 1960, Billboard magazine puts out an article and names Barry Gordon and suggests that he's going to be starting three brand new record labels, one of which is Motown.
It was Gordy, not
Gordy.
Gordon.
Yeah. Actually, what
Barry Gordy.
Didn't you just say something you can't mispronounce and then mispronounce?
You know what? Here's the thing. Every time I'm going to do that. Every time.
Yeah.
I'm going to.
I expect it from Jake, but yeah, it's like I'm still going to politely correct him. So,
for our listeners' sake, of course.
But then again, if I say something wrong, I fully expect to be corrected as well. So it's not like I'm trying to diss him or anything. It's just it is what it is. I expect correction for myself. I give out correction to other people. Sorry. That's just the way I am. But we got something exciting for the next one.
Mm-hmm.
The very first album review that was ever done, the very first episode for Follow the Sound, was because of this next day, which was 1966. The Beach Boys released the album Pet Sounds in the U.S.
Yay!
I love this album, like, so much. It just is mind-bogglingly good. Just how it was all put together. And if you want to go back, listen to the first episode of Follow the Sound. I go through it, and you can honestly hear like how much I love that album, because I'm very respectful to it as well in my first episode, even though it may be a little dull, just how because I'm not as exciting on the first episodes as I am now, in my opinion. But
I wish I had a gif of how excited you were just now to be talking about this album.
you do that little video. Like,
yeah.
That's my little happy dance. Sorry. So the album is obviously regarded as the masterpiece of Brian Wilson. Pet Sounds has been widely ranked as one of the most influential albums ever released, and it is ranked number one on several music magazines' list of greatest albums of all time, including New Musical Express, The Times, and Mojo Magazine. In 2003, it was ranked number two in the Rolling Stones' 500 Greatest Albums of All Time. On number one in that list was Sgt. Pepper, which was the direct response from the Beatles because of the Pet Sounds album.
Wow.
So,
I wonder how long they sat in that room and was like, do we make this one number one and that one number two, or this one number one and that one number two?
So if you go back and you listen to the first episode, you can hear some of these stories. But what it is that Brian Wilson heard Rubber Soul and was like, wow, this is amazing. I want to make an album that sounds better than this. And so he went, created Pet Sounds, they record it, and like before it even gets released, though, people are finding out about it, and I believe it was John and Paul, they wanted to listen to it, and so Brian happened to be in London at the time. They contacted him and said, hey, can we come and listen to that? And they like go up to his hotel room, they listen through it, again, and then they like basically walked out after that. And then, like, the conversation went later on. They were like, that's the greatest thing we've ever heard. We have to beat that. And so then that's what prompted them to start recording Sgt. Pepper.
Wow.
So Paul McCartney still regards it as one of the best albums ever. So there
I'm
you go.
Glad to know that story.
It's very good. But if you go back, listen to the first episode. I might share it again on Facebook and stuff just to throw that one out there just because it was released this week. So.
Do the old Throwback Thursday.
That'll be good. Well, yeah. It would have been today. I would have had to release it today, like, for it to be on the day. So I can still probably do that, though, before midnight is out. But let's see. Moving on. Another iconic album is also released the exact same day, and that is, of course, in 1966, Bob Dylan's Blonde on Blonde. Mm.
That was such an iconic album for that time.
Mm-hmm. Like, it's kind of crazy just because of, I mean, with Blonde on Blonde, like, it really sort of cemented Dylan, like, post-folk stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I know he had done electric stuff before there, but with Blonde on Blonde, it gained him an even bigger audience and just made him insanely popular after that. So
I think a lot of it, too, for that particular album was that he was saying a lot of things that people didn't know how to say
mm-hmm.
at that time. And so it resonated so deeply with people that that's why it gained popularity so quickly, is because everybody was trying to say what he was able to express.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I got a lot of respect for Dylan, so... Mm-hmm. I'm not his biggest fan or anything by any stretch of the imagination, because I really enjoy with Pet Sounds or the Beach Boys, I really love harmonies and I really love cool melodies and stuff. And Dylan never really did that. Dylan was basically the music was a vehicle for his lyrics,
mm-hmm.
and for Brian Wilson, the music was the vehicle for emotions. And the lyrics then just also conveyed that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a completely different take on how to actually produce music. But still, I mean, dude is brilliant in his own right.
Yeah.
So, but it's just amazing to me that two very, very just great albums were released on the exact same day in 1966.
Nobody even knew it was about to hit them.
Nobody knew at all. But... nobody knew what was about to happen next.
Yes. 1983, the 25th anniversary of Motown. There was a TV special, and the world was introduced to Michael Jackson and the moonwalk.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yep.
1983,
and
the moonwalk.
And the world collectively shit itself.
Yeah, kind of, because everybody was like, oh, my Lord, he's a magician.
Yeah.
I didn't find out until maybe like 5 years ago how he did the lean.
Mm-hmm.
Where he was able to lean so far forward and not mm-hmm. fall over. I'd try to do that for years as a kid. I never could. I was like, maybe am I crooked? Am I like, what am I doing? I had no idea that all of the work that went into making him be able to pull off such amazing choreography.
Yeah, I remember seeing that too and just being floored as a child, yeah. Like being just like, oh my goodness.
It's kind of a stickler to me though, because like he wasn't the first person to do that.
No, he wasn't.
Like
no.
James Brown and Cab Calloway did it.
Yeah, I mean there are videos going back, I mean well into the 30s of people yeah. doing something similar to the moonwalk. There's people even going back further who did the whole lean thing mm-hmm. too. So I mean, it's not like it's just that he took it and introduced it to a new audience on a broader platform.
Because if you want to make a list about things Cab Calloway did first that other people got credit for, we'll be here all night.
I guess
that is true.
And honestly, there's probably some like mime in like a 16th century like feudal court who was doing the moonwalk. You know, but it wasn't a moonwalk. He was, you know, walking
liege,
against a dragon.
Watch as I walketh on the moon.
yeah.
So there you go. All right. Moving on up. Here we go, guys. 1984. Yes. Ozzy Osbourne is arrested in Memphis, Tennessee for being staggering drunk down Beale Street. And, of course, he was released from jail about 5 hours later. After drying out, but he was not required to return for the court appearance, but he continued on the tour, you know, for support of 1983's Bark at the Moon. The reason why this is very significant, and it's honestly going to be the picture for this week's in music history, is because he's there, standing there with the little board, his name, Memphis Police Department, wearing a blues jersey.
Oh.
Really?
A St. Louis Blues jersey, and it is just, it's such a great picture, because he's just like sort of blank, just staring at the camera, but it's just the fact that like something that is so iconic for St. Louisans, like, are you showing him?
Yeah. I wish I had that. That is sick. hair's blonde. I forgot his hair was blonde.
That's a really cool photo, yeah.
Yes. So that's the photo blonde that I'm totally using for the posts on social media this week.
He does look super drunk. You know what?
Oh, yeah. Like, we talked about James Brown's drunk interview on TV. Ozzy Osbourne, like, every interview of him between, like, 1978 and 1992 were James Brown, like, level of drunk. Where he just got lost in mid-sentence.
Why is that, ladies?
Anyhow.
Moving on up, 1990, another sad day in music history.
Mm-hmm. Sammy Davis Jr. succumbs to cancer.
Mm. Oh. That is, yeah. So, Sammy Davis Jr., of course, like, superb entertainer. Well known for being, like, the short, skinny dude who was in the Rat Pack with, mm-hmm. with all the rest of those classic Vegas performers. But he like... had just a superb career in music and in theater and in film and all over the place. It's like, just, it's amazing to me. And he was an amazing tap dancer, too. Mm-hmm.
I don't think people quite know the depth of how far his work reached out unless you really look into it. I think people know, you know, like he was in the Rat Pack and, you know, a couple of his tunes and things like that. But I really don't think people in depth realize the breadth of his work,
yeah,
and how much it influenced.
Oh yeah, it influenced a lot of people. I mean, he did a ton of stuff, and I mean, I'm looking at even just his IMDb page right now, and it just like he's still being used in soundtracks and mm-hmm. everything, like for all the music and stuff that he does. Jake, are you okay?
It sounded like a goose.
Wow.
Sorry about that. I've got a mountain of tissues and an entire trash can on top of this
once
desk
again,
here.
Repeating that he is sick. So
I tried to even move my mic away a little so I wouldn't catch your honking. Oh. And it's
so, I'm trying to stay out of the cardioid pattern as best I can, but these walls do have some bounce to them.
So the funny thing for me is that I remember, like, Sammy Davis Jr. always did, like, I mean, he well known for all of this stuff that he did before. The one time that I actually really paid attention to him, though, was because I watched a movie from 1989 called Tap. Now, Tap here, of course, starred Gregory Hines and Sammy Davis Jr. and a bunch of other people as well. And Sammy Davis Jr. owned, like, a dance studio, and he and Gregory Hines had a little tap-off very early on in the movie. And then, like, Sammy died, like, the next year. And so it was one of, like, his last three movies that he was actually a part of. But if you ever want to go back, it was basically, like, one of those movies that they made in the 80s of, like, you know, let's find one central theme of tap dancing, and we will just make an 80s film around this.
Like Xanadu did for roller skating.
Exactly. So it's that level of film, but it's still highly entertaining.
I can imagine a tap-off between Gregory Hines and Sammy Davis Jr. would be highly entertaining
and
in and of itself.
And of course it ends with a great musical number of Gregory Hines tapping and singing.
Ooh. Well.
But he's not just tapping in any normal way. He's tapping with like basically MIDI triggers in his taps.
He was
and
tapping
so it's programmed to make sounds and stuff differently than like normal tap. It's actually really cool to watch. So you get a chance to watch the movie Tap, starring Gregory Hines and Sammy Davis Jr.
At the end, he brought in a cat and the cat tap danced.
I was going to say, was there a cartoon character that tap danced with him as well?
There was no cartoon cat character. I am sorry for that.
Paula Abdul had that guy.
Doesn't sound like a good movie to me.
As long as it's a cartoon cat that's been voiced by Danny DeVito, that's all I care about.
Hey, you guys, tap dancing on there?
Which is exactly what he did in the movie Last Action Hero.
I'm Callie the cat. You guys want to dance?
He's one of the finest officers on the force. Moving on up, though, we're going to jump two decades to 2010. And an absolutely devastating day for rock history. Jake, do you want me to take this one or do you want to handle it?
Yeah, I don't know if I'm over it yet.
Okay. 2010, Ronnie James Dio dies.
No.
Of course, he was the singer for Elf, Rainbow, and Black Sabbath. And then, of course, his long touring solo career as Dio. He died after a six-month battle with stomach cancer. He was 67 years old.
He's the rainbow in my heart.
He's the rainbow in the dark. They hadn't made any announcements. Nobody knew that he was sick or anything.
Yeah, it was a total shock to me. I mean, I hadn't been following him for a while. I would, you know, see him come up on Tenacious D stuff and things like that and be super entertained, you know. But I hadn't, pay close attention to him, you know, for a while before that. And to hear it, it was just like a knife through the heart.
It is true, too, because when you saw him in Tenacious D and the Pick of Destiny, I mean, you could tell he was getting a little old and frail. But
he could still wail.
He, was just so powerful in that one bit in Kickapoo that he gets to do.
In the City of Fallen Angels!
Yes! Where the ocean meets the sand.
Yeah, there's a Jack Black story that he tells about recording that song, and Dio came into the studio and broke like two microphones.
Yeah, doesn't he
just from singing?
Yeah,
wasn't he the one you said he brings his own mic?
Yeah, yeah, he had a ribbon mic with him because it's really hard to like scream a ribbon of aluminum in half. So he's like, hey, you want me to go out and like, you know, get my mic? And they're like, sure.
You know you got some vocals when you have to bring your own mic, because if you don't, you will destroy the one that was provided for you.
I'm going to break your mic, so I just went ahead and brought my own.
Yeah.
Couldn't just throw like a Shure 57 in front of him? That thing will take anything.
Maybe.
Yeah, it'll take a car crash.
So here we go. Let's run through his career a little bit. So Dio began his career in 1957 with the Vegas Kings, which later changed their name to Ronnie and the Rumblers, then Ronnie and the Redcaps, and then in 61, Ronnie Dio and the Prophets. So one band, five names. You pick your choice on which one you like best. And then Dio and the Prophets, guitarist Nick Pantis, formed the Electric Elves, which just shortened their name to Elf. The band's success eventually landed them an opening slot for Deep Purple. So they opened for Deep Purple, which exposed Dio to Deep Purple's guitarist, Richie Blackmore, who later then recruited Dio and the other members of Elf to form his new band, Rainbow.
Richie Blackmore's Rainbow.
Yep.
Yes.
And then
just Rainbow.
And then just Rainbow, where Richie Blackmore left.
Yes. Mm-hmm. And it was just Dio just rocking it out. And the other thing, too, that I truly loved about Dio was that, you know, when it comes to his influence on metal in and of itself, is that the stuff that he wrote, the stuff that he's famous for, is really kind of epic fantasy stuff, you know, of which he was this tiny, like, just tiny man. It's amazing to see, like, some of the videos that he made, because there he is, like, walking around with, like, a sword and stuff, and the sword's, like, twice his height, and it's just like, but there he is wielding it. But
it is.
It's just kind of, it was amazing to me because, you know, when you see the stuff of like the evolution of metal, it's like Dio really, really shaped what was to come later on. Even though like it was a bit more rock than metal of what we think of metal as today, like that fantasy stuff is still like just prevalent throughout a lot of metal.
Yeah, like Ronnie James Dio, he kind of summons up like thoughts of medieval times with castles and dragons and stuff. Like that's how his rock always
even in that song in Kickapoo. It's like he doesn't say, you know, in Los Angeles. He goes, in the City of Fallen Angels, where the ocean meets the sand.
Yep.
You will form a strong alliance and the world's most awesome band. So there you go.
You can't forget Dave Grohl's awesome drumming while Ronnie James Dio is singing.
Yes, that's true. And then, of course, Dave Grohl being the devil later on.
The best thing ever.
Yeah. Do you know who he replaced when he came into Black Sabbath?
He replaced Osborne, right?
No,
he didn't?
No, he so Ozzy left in the middle of a tour.
Yes.
Like 2 days before a show. So they got Dave Walker from Fleetwood Mac to come in and finish that leg of the tour.
What?
Yeah. So they played like five shows with Dave Walker from Fleetwood Mac.
Weird.
Can you imagine having had tickets to a show and then showing up and it's Dave Walker?
I mean, I don't think it would be terrible.
It wouldn't, but I mean, that's just not what you were signing up for.
Some of the singers they had for Fleetwood Mac, like before Lindsay showed up, they were some good singers, though. Yeah. You know, that was never the problem.
But just interesting, Black Sabbath has had a couple of like really weird fill-in emergency lead singers.
They really have.
And Dave Walker knew it was a temp job when he came into it. But apparently, you know, it went well enough, I guess.
I guess so.
I limped on through that tour.
No, all right, moving on to May 17th. Jake, you're going to have to do this one.
1953, Ray Charles is in studio when he finds out that his mother died. And he finished recording that day, and everything that he laid down is what you hear on Sinner's Prayer.
Yeah.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
You can hear a lot of emotion on that album, but that makes it takes it to a whole different level now, knowing that he
when you know the backstory.
Yeah. Wow. Yeah.
It's amazing. But then we're going to jump ahead here, move us on to something a little bit happier. 1965, born on this day, Trent Reznor.
Woo!
Now, of course, Trent Reznor, singer, songwriter, done all the stuff with Nine Inch Nails. He's composed film scores and worked with a ton of people. Has also worked with Lindsey Buckingham on one of his albums that he released in the last few years. And Lindsey actually really likes working with him because of just how his mind works.
That makes him, I'm in shock here because I guess I didn't realize he was almost the same age as my mom.
Well, there you go.
I can't wrap my brain around that. Like, my mom's super cool, but she's not Trent Reznor cool.
Well, my parents were both born in 51, so it's like they're older than that, but yeah.
That just blew my mind. I can't even Nine Inch Nails right now.
I still got to say, though, Nine Inch Nails still had one of the best shows that I've been to in the last few years. Light show wise, it's amazing. They've got one of the best light shows I've ever seen. I mean, they used like lasers and like three-dimensional projections and stuff because they had like a screen in the front, a screen in the middle, and then a screen in the back, and they projected three different things on it. So like from the front, it looked like a three-dimensional object on stage, like just really, really cool stuff. And then on top of that, opening for them was Explosions in the Sky, which is like one of my all-time favorite instrumental groups. So there you go. It's
did
like
you just leave that show on a cloud. My goodness,
it was amazing to me because Trent Reznor, like he picks exactly who he wants to open, so he doesn't care like if the fans care who opens. He wants hit the people that he wants. So he picked them, and like they go out there, and mind you, at the Nine Inch Nails show, you've got a lot of the typical Nine Inch Nails fans. They're decked out in black. They're pretty goth looking.
Industrial goth. Yeah.
Yes. And like, you know, and then Explosions in the Sky get up there and they're like super chill and they do their thing and it's super powerful too, and it's, you know, really emotional. But you can tell the crowd was basically just like, wait, why is this band opening for Nine Inch Nails?
I saw Tool once and Melt Banana open for them. And I felt like I was literally the only person in the room that had ever even heard of Melt Banana.
That would have been a good show.
Why would they? But Tool picked who they wanted to open for them, and they picked Melt Banana.
Eventually, we're going to get to one of the greatest mismatches for opening band ever.
You're
going to
say Jimi Hendrix
opening for the Monkees?
Yeah, yeah.
He only played like three shows on that tour.
Yeah.
Before they were like, "All right, Jimmy, this isn't working out."
Yeah, look, you're great. You're great. We love you, but like the 13-year-olds just aren't going to do it.
Jimmy's up there playing Purple Haze, and like the girls in the crowd are just like, "We want Davey. We want Davey.
We'll take Peter even."
Hey, Peter's awesome. Peter actually comes and hangs out in St. Louis every so often. So
I would love to meet Peter. He was my favorite Monkey.
Mine too, actually, because he was the most talented.
Mm-hmm. I always thought so too.
He was goofy, yes, on the show, but he was always the most talented like musician in the group.
He was always my favorite on the show.
He played everything. So
he was my favorite on the show. I started wearing beanies.
He always kind of hated the fact that he was portrayed as being such an idiot, like on the show, because he's really not.
Mm-hmm.
But at the same time, he got super famous from it, so he understands how that goes. But yeah, we're going to do a Monkees review like one of these days, like just like a total artist review or not, you know, our band review of the Monkees and basically their catalog.
I'll be here for that.
Not to be confused with our Wednesday night
totally,
Monkees review.
I totally binged watched like every Monkees episode when they released the like big DVD set and my library got it. And so I went and got them, and my dad and I, like, watched every episode of it, including the specials that were at the end of it.
I just got my St. Louis library card. I would love to do that.
So there you go.
I am new to St. Louis. I just
probably,
got my card.
You can probably go there and get it ordered or whatever. So
I would love to do that. Could we watch the monkeys with me?
Yes.
Just for research purposes?
Yeah. It's.
I still thought it that
much. Educational.
I still like my joke about not to be confused with our monkey review, where they just bring out the monkeys and.
I still love. What's the song? Hanging Around? What am I doing hanging around? Mm-hmm. That's probably my favorite one, actually, out of the ones on the TV show. So
it's like out of all the.
I'm not typical when it comes to the stuff that I like. I latch onto things, and so for some reason that song really stuck with me.
Well, I wouldn't that expect you to daydream believer it. But.
No. But that one and Mickey Dolan's doing "Going Down" is just brilliant.
I think Mickey was underutilized sometimes in that band. I really do. I feel like Mickey had a lot more to offer.
Well, he had to learn how to play drums to be on the show. So, and even then, he still wasn't. That's my biggest pet peeve of the entire show, though, is the fact that he'll be playing drums, then he's supposed to start singing, and he stops and like grabs the microphone. I was like, "But you're supposed to be playing drums right now. What's going on?
How does that work?"
All right, moving on up though. I don't know how we really sidetracked over there to the monkeys, but whatever. Moving on up to 1963, the first Monterey Folk Festival took place over 3 days in Monterey, California. If you've ever been to Monterey, California, you are in one of the most beautiful places on earth, in my opinion. So, like, I know everybody talks about LA and stuff like that, but Monterey is gorgeous, especially like the drive-in. So the festival featured Joan Baez, Bob Dylan, and Peter, Paul, and Mary.
That sounds so pleasant.
Yes. Later on down the line, and I cannot wait for this one to pop up in music history, though. In 1967, it was no longer the Monterey Folk Festival. It was the Monterey Pop Festival. Featured some of the greatest performances of bands that had never really been seen in America, including The Who and Jimi Hendrix and, like, just a ton of other people, including... closing out the entire shebang with Ravi Shankar. Yes.
I picture the Monterey Folk Festival, just a lot of people on blankets, you know, like
that's exactly what it was.
Back and forth, everybody's singing Puff the Magic Dragon with Peter, Paul, and Mary. You know, we're really enjoying our day. This is so nice. This is so peaceful. I'm really glad to be here.
Yeah.
Keep
but I honestly,
sunny side
I honestly cannot wait, though, until when we get to the Monterey Pop Festival. I almost want to do an entire episode of just it.
Probably could.
And just play clips of the performances. I think it'll be brilliant. I'd love to do some like actual like concert reviews like that. That are documented from history. So, like, do that one. Do Woodstock. Mm-hmm. Do, like, the concert for George that they had for George after he died, the year after he died. Mm-hmm. Was just brilliant. Yeah. You know, do some of that kind of stuff and play clips from that. That'd be very cool. If you like that idea, find us on Facebook or Twitter and tell us that you like that idea. And then we will get to doing it sooner than later. So
give us a like.
And one random Red Hot Chili Peppers concert.
Give us one of those thankful flowers so we can watch it go blue, 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 blue.
All right. Then.
So 1971, Godspell opens off Broadway at the Cherry Lane Theater in New York, New York.
Prepare ye the way of the Lord. There you go. That's the opening song to Godspell, if you didn't know.
Godspell is probably my favorite musical.
Mine too. And not just because I played in it, yes, and you starred in it.
I did.
Back in high school.
Did
that was
you
great.
Really?
I was the drummer, and Jake was actually one of the players. So
like anywhere where there's an audience, I will be.
And
like,
Jake was God.
Jake was good.
Jake played God.
No. See, here's the thing. I
Brian
mean, okay.
Was the spell.
You can. Jake here. Like, he doesn't do anything with it now except for apparently talk on podcasts. But he was actually a good actor back in high school.
If you say so. I will never.
We did a performance of Twain
brag
by the Tail.
On my adolescent portrayals of anything.
Senior year, we did Twain by the Tail, and he just dominated that show.
I did have four costume changes.
He was hilarious. Like,
not to brag, but it was big enough that I had four costume changes.
I had to wear a dress in that performance, so
you
I didn't like that
one
as much.
You should have seen him in Cats.
Yeah, that was.
So, but yes, Godspell.
He was so nimble.
Godspell is honestly
was,
one of my favorite
Mr.
musicals.
Mr. Tim
so.
Tom and another character whose name I don't remember because I've never watched Cats.
The magical
I saw it
Mr.
once. That was enough.
Yeah. Godspell's kind of like a wider Jesus Christ Superstar.
Yeah.
If that makes sense.
It's
like a Glee Club version of Jesus Christ Superstar.
Whiter, not wider.
Yeah, whiter.
Okay, I was going like, what is it? Okay.
I'd actually say it's this.
I know it's your...
I would say it's different than that, though.
Five tonsils right now.
Okay, so Jesus Christ Superstar was kind of like the more serious representation of like the Jesus story in musical form. And it was very much rock oriented.
Mm-hmm.
Godspell was more the fun, playful side of that story. And that's like it was definitely more of the hippie influence for that one than for Jesus Christ Superstar.
And where does Joseph and the Amazing Technicolor Dreamcoat come into all
that
this?
It falls into the same thing with Godspell. It's like that sort of fun, playful side of it, especially when you get like Donny Osmond.
Yeah, Glee Club
in it, so.
Equals Donny Osmond.
No, but Godspell is honestly like one of my favorite musicals, and not just because I played it and I know every song, but just because I thought all of the songs were really cool and I thought they were very clever and I thought the storyline was, you know, for a story about Jesus, it was very well put together, you know? And it actually does follow the Bible too, which I also thought was pretty nice. So it's not like blatantly blasphemous. Like some of the parts of Jesus Christ Superstar are like, okay, really? But the thing that always threw me off about Jesus Christ Superstar, especially the movie, is that they made the best singer, like, the bad guy.
Yeah.
It's like the guy who played Judas, like, honestly, the best singer in the entire musical, and he just is amazing. And it irked me because it's like, oh, come on. It's like, you couldn't have made him somebody else. It's like...
Like, why does the villain have to be the dashingly handsome man?
I would have been fine if they'd made him Jesus, actually. It's like...
It's like what they did for Les Mis. They made Russell Crowe the worst singer. It's like the obvious. Javert was the worst singer in the movie, and he was the villain, so you didn't feel too bad about it.
But there you go. Godspell. It's amazing.
This is my pet peeve with Jesus Christ Superstar. I don't like that it vilified Judas. I've always felt that the audience should be the villain in any Jesus story.
Because they wanted to crucify him?
I don't know. It just seems to make sense in like a weird, like Klaus Nomi eclectic kind of.
I'm going to have to watch it because in all the stories I've heard, Judas is a pretty bad dude.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know. Look, there's a really good Judas story out there just waiting to get written by someone with talent.
The funny thing is that in our version of Godspell, one character played John the Baptist and Judas. And so it was kind of confusing because he starts out the entire show singing that "Prepare ye the way of the Lord," and then at the end of it, he kills himself. It's like, wait a second,
on players?
Yes.
Okay.
It was short on singers.
We were a private school, and so we didn't have like a ton of talent to go around. But it was still a lot of fun. But Jake was still very funny in it.
Thanks.
You and Terrence like were the funny ones of that entire thing. So.
Anytime I'm in the same
random
conversation
reference of
Terrence Pruitt, it's...
Hey, I'm still friends with him on Facebook.
Well,
so.
Congratulations. We should probably move on to the next
one. We're getting into too personal of story now, so sorry about that. But Terrence, if you actually listen to this, you know, send us a message
or something. Hi, Terrence.
Say hello, Terrence.
Moving on to 1975, here you go. Elton John was awarded the platinum record for the sales of a million copies of his LP, Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy, the first album to ever be certified platinum on the day of its release.
Now you want to talk about album titles.
Yeah.
Yeah, lay it on me.
Could have just gone for Elton John.
There's no expectation at all behind that.
Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy.
It should have just been the Brown Album.
Yep, the Brown Album.
Fuck you, Greg.
Through tissues. Fuck you, Greg.
Oh, my goodness, you guys. Moving on to May 18th. Cruising along right now.
1950. Mark Mothersbaugh of Devo is born in Akron, Ohio.
Whip it!
He is so beyond just Devo, though.
Well, that's true.
He's so beyond just Devo. I feel like he's always like pigeonholed like he was in Devo, but he's done so much great stuff.
You mean that band with the goofy hats?
All right, find that. Mark Mothersbaugh of Mark Mothersbaugh is born.
Actually, the funny thing for me is everybody knows Whip It from Devo, but like that's it. That's the only thing that they know of. I actually also know of an entire album that they did that was never like fully released mm-hmm. because it was the soundtrack to a video game. And I have that soundtrack.
Devo did so many things, and everybody just remembers them for Whip It. Mm-hmm. And then Mark goes out here after Devo is, you know, kind of
gone,
chilling, doing nothing, you know, not doing that. And he goes and he just creates these amazing scores and soundtracks. And it's ridiculous how talented he is. And mm-hmm. he gets pigeonholed so much for that.
Just for Devo with the goofy hats.
Yes.
See,
yeah.
I thought you were going to say like a whole album of Whip It remixes.
No. So the name of the video game was Interstate 82. Interstate 76 had one of the best soundtracks to any video game ever made, and it was just all like funk music. So Interstate 82, the entire soundtrack was done by Devo, and so it's 12 songs that Devo released just for this video game, and they're sort of all like car themed or speed themed or something along those lines. But it's still a really, really good album. Like it's classic Devo sound, but it's like all of these Devo songs that you've never heard before. So.
He's maintained a lot of relevance still. He has his own segment on Yo Gabba Gabba every week.
Mm-hmm.
He collaborated with
for the Rugrats theme, you know,
with Weird Al Yankovic for the Dare to Be Stupid mm-hmm. tour.
Mm-hmm.
And then hated Weird Al after it.
Because he took the song and made Dare to Be Stupid.
Stupid, yeah.
And he thought that that was ridiculous.
Right.
To which he was like, my name is Weird Al.
You're like, what did you think I was going to do? Like, yeah.
Have you heard of me? Because that's my thing.
And Dare to Be Stupid like, is my
I got
favorite
on
Weird
television
Al album. So, and I love
playing
that song.
An accordion while somebody drummed on an accordion box and I sang my Bologna.
My Bologna.
Yeah.
Moving on up, 1964, a riot broke out in Hamilton, Scotland during a Rolling Stones UK tour when over 4,000 fans with forged tickets gate-crashed the band's gig at Chattingall Hotel.
Dude, we should do that for every concert you can't get into.
Now
just
I can
just
see
make
more
forged
concerts.
Tickets.
Well, this is brilliant.
Just get a group of friends together and be like, we've got tickets. And then we all just storm the door at the same time and just die. And we have tickets and just push our way in.
Yeah, I like it.
Yeah. Well, I mean, all tickets pretty much look the same like nowadays from a cursory glance.
You just print them off your computer.
You just hold up a piece of blank white paper and just, I have a ticket.
Now, we at the Follow the Sound podcast do not encourage any kind of forgery or breaking the law of any kind.
That is true. We do not encourage them. I wouldn't be happy if any bad thing happened because of our podcast.
The comments on this show are strictly those of the individuals themselves and do not reflect anything.
Strictly the opinions of Greg Harvey.
You rabble rouser. You hooligan.
The damn mad commander. Anyway, 1978, the
yes.
Buddy Holly story opens in theaters.
Love that
starring
movie.
Starring Gary Busey. And there you go. That was a movie. It was in theaters.
Gary Busey.
Yeah.
I don't care about the movie at all.
In theaters.
I just care that afterwards, Gary Busey bought Buddy Holly's guitar, the Gibson mm-hmm. acoustic mm-hmm. with leather wrapped around it that Buddy Holly had tooled himself his own name in and everything.
Wow.
At auction, yeah.
That's
Didn't
cool.
We just hear a story recently about they found his glasses.
We did it out here
you,
on the show.
Oh,
yeah,
I heard
we
it
did
on
it on
the show.
Yeah.
It's like, what news program did I hear that on?
That was Follow the Sound.
Yeah. I wasn't on that episode.
No, you were not.
That was the one where they found his glasses disappeared from the crash.
Mm-hmm.
And years, like 30 years later, they turned up in a small town police station filing cabinet. And, yeah.
Wow.
Mm-hmm. In Iowa, because that was where the crash was.
Was there more to that story, Jake?
Yeah. So the current owner, Gary Busey, sold the guitar. For I don't know why, but the current owner is a real estate developer in Seattle who at one point was a co-owner of DMX Music. And have you ever seen the Jimi Hendrix bronze statue?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The one where he's on his knees playing the guitar with his head back? Well, the same guy that owns his guitar commissioned that statue. And he's kind of a big feature in Seattle with promoting like local musicians.
I wonder if he had anything to do with the museum that's there. Like the pop music.
He might have. He's probably got a name on a plaque somewhere.
If you're ever in Seattle, you got to go to that place. It's super cool. Like, Just really, really cool how they've got it set up.
And also, Mark Malone, you are a difficult man to find out anything about. Like, I was pulling information from like a newsletter for a Seattle Police Department benefit letter.
Wow.
To like try and find out like who the, I heard his name mentioned with somebody was playing the guitar on a YouTube video. And the current owner, you know, my friend Mark Malone, he loaned us his guitar so we could play it in front of you today. Hmm. And that was like 4 hours later.
Wow.
Jimmy Hen, I'm reading articles from 1997 when the statue was commissioned. Anyway.
In 1980, another sad day in music history, Joy Division singer and guitarist Ian Curtis hanged himself in the kitchen of his house. I'm not even going to try to pronounce that city name. Yes, I am. Macclesfield in England. He was 23 years old. Curtis had the Iggy Pop album The Idiot playing on the stereo and left a note that said, "At this very moment, I wish I were dead. I just can't cope anymore." Joy Division released the critically acclaimed debut album Unknown Pleasures in 1979 and recorded their follow-up Closer in 1980.
Mm. That is very sad.
Joy Division is a fascinating band. If you ever go back and you listen to, because you now know about the tragedy of it, like of Ian Curtis killing himself, you know, due to severe depression, and he had a lot of other mental issues that were involved, but he was able to sort of pour that out into music. And so when you go back and you listen to his music and you listen to his lyrics, it's like just blaringly obvious that there was something seriously wrong with him. That had people known about it, like, you know, after the fact, or had known more about like psychological issues, they could have actually gotten him help. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he could have gone on continuing to make music to this day. So just it's one of those crazy things. But it's very sad kind of music just because it's what he wrote. It's what he was experiencing at the time. So but his depression and anxiety and all of that kind of stuff filtered into some really great music. But such a tragedy. And then let's see, moving on here to 1985. Simple Minds were at number one in the U.S. singles chart with Don't You Forget About Me.
Don't.
Of course, it was written by Keith Forsey, who won an Oscar for Flashdance and the song What a Feeling. And Steve Schiff, who was the guitarist and songwriter for Nina Hagen Band. And the track was obviously featured in the 1985 film The Breakfast Club.
That movie had a great soundtrack.
So, yes, but closing out with that song, it just was a great little finishing point to that movie. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, it was later utilized in the movie Pitch Perfect, which most of the people who saw that movie had no clue who that band was or what that movie was. And therefore, Pitch Perfect just stole it.
It was a bit blasphemous. But that final scene where the song starts and Judd Nelson just, like you said, he's got the coat on and his fists in the air and they freeze frame it. And you're just like, yeah.
Yes.
I'm a misfit, too.
Yeah. Forget about Judd Nelson.
I never will. And, of course, moving on to our final day, May 19th.
Here we are. 1940. Born Mickey Newbury. Does that name ring a bell for anyone?
No.
No? Well, no. Maybe the song Just Dropped In to See What Condition My Condition Was In.
I just dropped in to see what condition my condition was in. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, pretty prolific country writer. He wrote for many decades.
Hmm.
And, yeah, there you go. Name dropping Mickey Newbury.
It's a great song. It really is.
It's a good song.
From Kenny Rogers, that's what's amazing.
Yeah, it was a great Kenny Rogers song.
I can't believe that a Kenny Rogers song still holds up.
Gotta know when to hold
him. Yeah, he's got a couple solid tracks.
No, that does not hold up. That thing is stuck.
You want to know something funny, though?
Everybody knows that song.
Kenny Rogers does not consider himself country.
Well, congratulations, Kenny.
He never has.
He had a fried chicken franchise.
So, but you got to remember, in his day and age, country was not what he was.
I mean, he wasn't like country western like Conway Twitty was.
He was the start of a new wave of country that then followed after him. But he wasn't trying to start anything. he considered himself just sort of like a pop artist, really. Mm-hmm. But he just happened to have a Southern sort of twang to him. But if you listen to a lot of his earlier stuff, it's not country. Like, there are no slide guitars. There's, like, you know, none of that kind of stuff.
The only reason a song like Islands in the Stream would be considered country is because he sang it with Dolly Parton, and they both have twangs in their voices.
Which he originally didn't want to do. But his producer was like, look, you gotta bring her in. It's like, because it's going to be brilliant. And he was like, yeah, fine, whatever. And then she comes in, and he said, like, the moment they started singing, it was just blatantly clear that this was their song together.
It
so.
Was magical.
I know. This is my impression of his manager. It's Dolly freaking Parton.
Yes.
I like how you did this.
You got to do it.
Just sticking your hands out like that? I totally missed it. I was looking away.
Well, I just was trying to have the emphasis, but I suppose you took that as my Dolly Parton impression. I just would like to mention that I've had some of Kenny Rogers' rotisserie-style chicken. It's pretty good.
Good for him.
Of course,
he's
this ended up as a
talents.
Talk about Kenny Rogers and not Mickey. But anyway.
Weirdly transitioned to Dolly Parton's boobs. Yeah.
But there's not a country artist from the 70s or the 80s that didn't do a Mickey song. Like Merle Haggard. Mm-hmm. Everybody did one. So.
Yep.
And, good on you, Mickey. Thanks for the music.
Okay, so moving on up to 1945, born on this day, the great Pete Townsend.
Yeah!
Now, for those of you who don't know, Pete Townsend is the guitarist and vocalist and songwriter for The Who.
The Who?
And, Jake,
yes.
this next week, though,
mm-hmm.
we're doing our album review of The Who, Who's Next.
Yes, we are.
And it'll be amazing. So stay tuned. You'll listen to that one. It'll be great. And hopefully you will enjoy that one, too. Should be coming out next Monday. So
he said Pete Townsend. It made me think of Peter Frampton.
No, not Peter Frampton.
No, not talking through your guitar. Tomahawk guitar playing.
But what we were discussing pre-show.
Oh, well.
And poor Peter
we're
Frampton.
We're not there yet.
Well, I'm not
Frampton.
Going there yet. I was just
Pete
saying
Townsend.
While I was chuckling.
Pete Townsend.
So.
Let my love open the door.
Let my love open the door.
I love that song. I put that on the playlist for our deli.
Our Eminence Front. It's a put on.
See, now I know we've talked about the in some of the other stuff. But the first time that I really remember focusing on Pete Townsend was when I saw him perform an acoustic set on the video The Secret Policeman's Private Parts. And it was amazing because he did Drown and he did Won't Get Fooled Again.
Mm.
And he did them acoustic and it just blew me away. So that was the first time I really started paying attention to what he did. So also born on this day, 1952. Jeffrey Hyman.
You may have know him better as
Joey Ramone.
There you go. Oh. The ugliest man in rock and roll.
So Joey Ramone, fascinating cat. If you ever get a chance to check out his story, obviously you need to do so. But I like to credit the Ramones as sort of doing the rebirth of 50s rock and roll. Just sort of in a slightly faster version of it, and with a little bit more oomph behind the guitars. So
he puts true. The ugly into the music.
That's true.
I've always kind of felt like, to an extent, like punk rock music was that reincarnation of the 50s original rock, where it's just sped up.
2.5 minute songs, just rocking out.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Because, there's a lot of songs that come out nowadays, too, but the Ramones are a perfect example where you slow it down, make it a little more sing-songy, and you've got your 50s hit.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. That's one. And, of course, you use it in Rock and Roll High School. And
yeah.
Rock and Roll High School.
Yeah, you could hear the Beach Boys doing, like, a rendition of that or something.
Mm-hmm.
Rock and Roll High School.
Well, and they did covers. They did a Beach Boys song. I remember that. So,
mm-hmm. Like, and they do, well, it was the solo stuff that was What a Wonderful World.
Moving on up to 1960, American DJ Alan Freed was indicted along with 7 others for accepting $30,000 in payola from 6 record companies. 2 years later, he was convicted and given a suspended sentence and a $300 fine.
And ruined it for the rest of us for generations to come.
Ruined his career and, like, all sorts of stuff. And then, of course, I mean, with the whole Paola scandal, like, which is ridiculous itself, like, because later on it just transitioned into other things. But it's like, I mean, so what? It's like, let people pay to get music on air. Whoop-de-doo. It's not that big of a deal.
And
like, but they took it as like some personal insult. It's like, these are the airwaves of the American public. You've got to respect that. It's like, no, they don't. Like, let them get paid $30,000 extra.
Yeah, you're thinking about it, though, in today's time frame. I mean, like, okay, so back in 1960, there was the airwaves. There was TV, AM, FM, UHF, right? I mean, and then you're done. There's nothing else.
Mm-hmm.
Like, where else are you going to get information from? You got newspapers, right?
They were playing music.
Yeah, what if they're paying them off too? It's a slippery slope, Brian, is all I'm saying.
News. It wasn't news radio. It was music radio, and they should be allowed to play whatever they want. And so what if a company shows up and says, hey, I'll give you money if you play my song this number of times?
I would play that song.
Yeah. To me, it's not that big of a deal. And they made it out to be a huge deal.
Just think about all the terrible music we might be subjected to, though, if we still have that.
Think of all the great music we could have heard.
I don't think so. If you have to pay me that much to play your stupid song...
It would have balanced out after a while, all right? It would have balanced out after a while.
It would have been like nothing but Rebecca Black's Fridays.
I wish
which
about
it
to
was.
Say that same song.
Which it was
point.
For a while, so, you know, none of that.
Well, yes, exactly.
Now I got the damn song stuck in my head.
And then
fuck
not
you,
to
Greg.
Mention and then not to mention what it would have created would have been the counter to those people. Because then you would have had the DJs who were like, I am not accepting a dime from these companies. The music that you're getting is the music that I want to play. And then those people would have become popular too. Like, it would have
right, of course, because in your world, pirate radio always triumphs.
Yeah, it did. And evidence of that is in the UK.
Okay.
Well, but you know, that's what I'm thinking, though, is the DJ who
BBC
was,
couldn't control music at that time. Do you really think that the American government could stop it, too?
The DJ who played the music he wanted to play probably would have been, I would think, more listenable than the guy who just kept playing that same song on repeat. But once again, time has proven me wrong in that theory as well. So, I don't know. I guess there's no answer to it except give me money.
I think Alan Freed got a bad rap. And I think that nothing should have happened with it, because basically what it did is it just made the companies give out payola in other ways.
Mm-hmm.
That's all it did.
Well, yeah. Yeah.
And so it became a completely different thing. Government steps in, tries to stop it, and it just creates an entirely other different black market for the system. Because that's what they do.
Yeah. Well, because anytime a big-name artist is coming to town, you know their songs get spiked on the radio anyways.
Absolutely.
To promote it.
To promote the show, because they're doing a promotion with the radio station, and it's like they're paying money, and like, you know, it becomes a whole different thing. So.
Yeah. On how many radio stations just have random buckets and boxes full of merch.
Free stuff, yeah.
From random artists, yeah.
Occasionally we get them. Around these parts.
I know. I have a whole CD binder full of CD, like demo CDs that people handed me while I was walking into work. Like, hey, play my CD. And I just have a whole album full.
Yep.
I have Taylor Swift sunglasses.
Yeah. Oh,
there you go.
Never heard of her.
Moving on up to 1962.
You might remember, well, you won't remember this, but I'm sure you've heard of it.
I remember it from when I was a child.
Marilyn Monroe. Sings John Fitzgerald Kennedy.
Happy birthday, Mr. President.
Thus proving the point that you can make anything sexy as shit.
You can also then have Mike Myers do a parody of it that everyone else will imitate from this moment on.
I was just wondering, how many people do you think of the current generation first heard of that occurrence watching Wayne's World and trying to figure out what he was talking about? And then, you know what I mean? Just like, I had no idea when I was a kid. I had not been exposed to that, but I was exposed to Wayne's World and the music and that kind of thing. So that was the first I looked it up to see what he was referring to.
Why is Wayne Campbell doing that?
Mr. President.
That's so original.
Which
isn't
funny.
Why would you add Mr. President into the happy birthday?
Of course, you think about that later on, because then there was another movie The Professional, or Leon the Professional, where a very young Natalie Portman does an impersonation basically of Mike Myers doing Marilyn Monroe, but dressed as Marilyn Monroe. And so it's like, but that cracked me up because the entire reason why she did that was because she saw Mike Myers do that impersonation.
Exactly.
Yeah. Which kind of proves that The Matrix doesn't actually.
She honestly had no idea who like any of those people were.
If it didn't fall apart in that like meta sinkhole of Happy Birthday. And it's never going.
So now
we could do an entire episode too of like just that song and how like demented that song's history has been.
Infinite universes with infinite Mike Myers impressions.
This is my impression of Natalie Portman doing Mike Myers doing Marilyn Monroe.
And I'm going to do my impression of you doing that.
That sounds like some of those songs that you hear people do like on The Voice or like X Factor or America's Got Talent or something. They're like, oh, I'm doing this person's song, which was a cover of this other person's song based on this version of this other song that this other person wrote in 1962.
And then they start bucket drumming.
Yeah.
This like, is my interpretation.
Got brooms tied to their feet. Yeah.
Just right. Spoons.
Fascinating.
And now I'm going to do Elton John's Candle in the Wind entirely on two spoons.
Speaking of low-budget productions, moving on up to 1978, Dire Straits released their first major label single, The Sultans of Swing, recorded on a budget of 120 pounds.
That is one of my favorite songs of all time. That's also on the playlist at the deli because I get to listen to whatever I want at work.
The song was first recorded as a demo at Pathway Studios in North London in July of 1977 and quickly acquired a following after it was put on rotation at a radio station.
I love Dire Straits. I have loved Dire Straits since I was a child.
Mm-hmm.
Love them. Walk of Life. I always used to sing it Walk on By when I was a kid because I thought that's what he was saying.
Nice.
But I was like, why would you do the Walk on By? That doesn't make any sense. Is he trying to avoid someone?
I always think of Sultans of Swing and they don't give a damn about any trumpet playing band.
So now, Mark Knopfler, of course, I guess that's my worst butchering of a name for me. Knopfler. He later on wrote one of my all-time favorite songs now, and it's called Boom Like That. Hmm. And it's just solo stuff that he did. The reason why I like the song Boom Like That, and Dad, if you're listening, you know what I'm about to say, is because it's the story of Ray Kroc, the founder of McDonald's, who made it popular and stuff. But the chorus goes, my name is Kroc, that's Kroc with a K, like crocodile, but not spelled that way.
Yeah.
That's wonderful.
And so it's become like our family song just for the chorus alone.
That's awesome. That's
so
precious.
Good,
like
and
that.
It's a good song. It really is a good song. So I like that a lot. But that was that song that then made me go back and really listen to Dire Straits and be like, okay, all right, I know where this dude's coming from now. But
Mr. Knopfler had some good tunes.
Mr. Knopfler. 1979, Jake, what you got?
Here we go. Three, no less than three Beatles play at Clapton and Boyd's wedding.
Oh.
Really?
Yes.
So was George there then?
Yes, he was.
Oh, okay. So which Beatle
who
wasn't
was
there?
The dead one?
John.
Uh-oh. Oh. So that would have been John at the time. Okay, yeah.
Sorry. I thought that would have been obvious.
Sorry, my ears confused.
That's
so.
All right.
For some reason, I always think that John was killed in like 83 or something. Like, I don't know why that date pops into my head.
I always think it's the 80s, too. So when you said the dead one, it took me a minute. I'm, like, wait.
I mean, I'm pretty sure he was already dead. I could be the mistaken one here, but just...
If Jake is wrong, find us on Facebook and Twitter and let him know.
It was actually Ringo. He was away writing stories about trains.
No, but Ringo, John, and George were there. And they were basically the band most of the night.
That would have been just so freaking amazing.
More or less impromptu. They just played whatever came to mind or what people requested.
Well, and John and Paul know like 1,000 songs anyway.
Right.
Like besides just the ones that they wrote. Like they could have stayed up there on like a stage all night, and then if Eric actually joined them for a while, which he probably did at some point, oh my God, could you imagine what that would have actually been like sitting there in that crowd, and then to have like food and cake, it would have been like a perfect night.
Oh, never mind. Okay, so he was killed in 80.
Oh, there you go.
So, all right.
So he just wasn't there then. Yeah.
Well, he was too busy getting ready to die to show up.
Well, he's
so.
probably like in New York or something and, you know, did that. But still, like, that just would have been so crazy to see. I would have loved to have seen that.
The dead one?
Not the dead one.
Best
I don't want to see the
catering
dead one.
Job ever. Can you imagine that? Like, you're like, don't want to put these shoes on today. I don't want to tie. I don't want this damn little bow tie I got to do. Why? Don't know why I can't have a clip on. Why can't I have a clip on? Maybe we could tie this thing every Wednesday. And then you show up, you know, and there's...
Oh, I know, right?
There's three Beatles playing.
Three Beatles and a Clapton.
And a Clapton.
Beatles and a Clapton.
Right. Ginger Butler is like just...
Baker
is just... Whatever. He's puking into a corner.
Ginger Plumber.
The
ginger blacksmith.
This is the not very observant caterer that was not aware that they were at Eric Clapton's wedding.
Who are these fools getting up on stage? Why aren't people eating my food?
Is that his brother or something? That's so lame.
These shoes are so uncomfortable.
This is the worst Beatles cover band I've ever heard.
Yeah, this Beatles tribute band sucks.
I can't believe that drummer thinks he can get away with wearing sunglasses inside.
Oh, man. Oh, that's so good. We almost need to end on that point. But I'm going to give one final shout out for the last thing on our list today. Born in 1992, Sam Smith.
Oh.
Okay.
Of recent pop fame, you know, with his great song.
Born in 92?
Yeah.
Get out.
Yeah, he's a youngin'.
That makes him like 25, 24, 25-ish.
So won't you stay with me?
I have to. You're a minor.
All I need. Yes, you need an adult.
So he, Sam Smith, I know, like, there's some people out there who really kind of give him flack, you know, just for, like, whatever stupid reason, because he's a pop singer.
And the Tom Petty thing, too.
Which, I mean, come on, he didn't steal it, so it's, and even Tom Petty was just like, look, I'm not suing him. It's like, it's the label that's doing this crap.
Yep.
It's like, he didn't want anything to do with that. He was like, let the dude write whatever song you want. He's like, which is actually really cool, because I actually saw Tom Petty last week when he was in town in St. Louis, and Joe Walsh opened for them. Fascinating show. It's one of those things where, I mean, they've been playing together for 40 years, and there literally wasn't a song on the list that I didn't know. And I've never truly, like, sat down and listened to Tom Petty records.
Oh, man. Dude, I love Tom Petty. And the fact that you said that there wasn't a song you didn't know, that really just kind of sparked for me. Because that's the thing with Tom Petty. When you go through, like, his greatest hits album and you realize that you've heard all of these songs before on the radio at one point or another. I mean, if you listen to any sort of rock radio... But and it's just they keep coming, and then you think to yourself, at least for me, it's like, oh yeah, Tom Petty, he is really good. Like, you kind of don't always keep him in the front of your mind.
Yeah.
And then you see his concert, and you're like, I know every single song.
Mm-hmm.
You know.
How many concerts do you think people have been to where they've known every song that was played? And I feel like somebody like Tom Petty would be one of the few that you would know every song,
because
if he didn't do his hits. He can do a concert just of hits because he has that many.
The only other one that I could probably think of would be when I saw Paul McCartney.
Mm-hmm.
Because, I mean, I know, like, everything Paul McCartney's ever done, really. So, at least as far as hits are concerned. So, yeah, I mean, it'd have to be that level of player, and that's exactly what Tom Petty is. So, and the Heartbreakers are still just a top-notch band.
Mm-hmm.
So. But yes, Sam Smith, we sidetracked to Tom Petty. Sorry about that. Sam, I actually think that Sam is a very talented singer, and I'm looking forward to seeing what he produces next as far as music goes. I think he's kind of been sort of stuck in the crooner like thing, and who knows, he could probably carry that on for a good while longer. But Sam, you're cool in my book. Keep making some good music. That's all I care about.
Don't let the man bring you down, Sam.
Yeah. So that's it for this week in music history. And I think it's been a fascinating show. We've gone a little bit longer than like an hour. So we're an hour and a half at this point. So, too bad. If you're listening at this point, we're happy. So, But if you want to help out the show because you enjoy it, you can always go to our website, followthesoundpodcast.com, and click on the Amazon banner. It takes you to Amazon. You can do all your normal shopping, and it won't cost you anything extra, and we get a little bit of money back just to keep doing some stuff. And I know some people out there have been buying some stuff because it's been popping up, you know, that we're getting money back, and I'm quite happy about that. So thank you if you have actually been purchasing stuff. Keep doing it. It's simple, it's easy, and it doesn't cost you anything. So go to the website, click on the banner, or go to followthesoundpodcast.com/Amazon. And that's it. That's my promotion. Boom.
Great job, Brian.
I would also like to thank lineupmedia.fm for allowing us to do the show. You can check out lineupmedia.fm at exactly that, lineupmedia.fm. You can check out other great shows, including the one that we were talking about before we even got started, Surreal Talk. It's everything with cults, conspiracies, and the paranormal, hosted by Eric and Everett. They are a fascinating group of guys, and they get some really good topics. And actually, right now, what they are doing, every topic every week, is crowdsourced. So therefore, their fans pick the topics that they do every week.
Good.
And this last week, they did an episode on Scientology.
Oh, my Lanta.
Dun, dun, dun. Which is actually a topic of conversation that pops up in my office for some random reason. We like to talk about how weird Scientology is, but it's a great show. Check them out at surrealtalk.com, I think is the name of their website, or surrealtalkpodcast.com, either one of those. Either way, search for it and you'll find it. Fascinating show, so go check them out. But other than that, I mean, there, I think we're done with the show. So I, of course, have been your host, Brian Kroc. Along with me has been Jacob Crum.
Thank you for your time. Thank you for your ears. Good night.
And Greg Harvey.
Arrivederci.
And Bree Park.
Thank you for playing.
If you hear it, follow the sound.
This podcast was a presentation of lineupmedia.fm.